We're told tonight at 8:43 Eastern Standard Time, the new moon in Sagittarius will be at its peak. This Sunday morning at 10:03, the winter solstice will occur, a quiet turning point in the year's rhythm as the days begin to grow longer. We're able to read a full explanation of these celestial movements in the Old Farmer's Almanac, complete with graphic images that compare a solstice with an equinox and such. Even if we understand the solstice scientifically, though, we might ask, but how does the solstice feel? In a different kind of almanac, Christine Gelineau writes, at the moment of solstice, the earth here in northeastern United States is deep in the glitteringly cold darkness, the sky moonless, cut with stars, while we two are cocooned in the warm pod of the automobile, floating home from a celebration, the black woodlots and inky swept-out hayfields interspersed with the cheerful smear and spray of Christmas lights on the houses we pass. Those holiday lights are the vestiges of ancient solstice fires, the bright, beseeching fires our distant ancestors built to lure back the waning sun, the after-solstice winter dawn, a dawning of yet one more chance a blossoming springtime will be on our horizon. Millennia on, we still nurse and nurture that flicker, that ember of human hope. Christine Gelineau connects with the winter solstice here on many levels. The personal, the feeling of warmth and safety as she is cocooned in the car passing through the landscape during the blackness of a night, alive though with lights, whether from Christmas lights or stars. And we experience with her what winter can mean for us, the farm fields lying fallow, the depth of the darkness despite those lights. Not a creature is stirring, except she herself, perhaps, and we cycle with her into deep time on earth when our ancestors sent out signals from firelight, beseeching pleas that we might not admit we make, too, in our dark, oh so dark times. But she dares to use the word hope, and she ends her December reflections with a hard-won avowal of hope. And that is the beauty of almanac, a murmuration, shaped into form through her rich imagination and true love of selecting a series of the right and truest words to tell those tales. Her stories are rooted always in a sense of embodied being, no pie in the sky, though she does revel in the glory of the cosmos and seasonal cycles that we are always a part of. And when she reads for us from almanac, we'll learn that she traces her very sense of selfness to times along an open beach, winding her way through the prehistoric horseshoe crabs on the sand, her bare feet sucked into the primordial ooze, as she describes it. Deep roots, indeed. And the form of the book is reflective of the rhythms of our living. There are chapters titled for the months of the year, January through December, each with 12 sections. So there is a framework for containing but not limiting the dynamism of life. When even in disorder we can learn from chaos theory, there does seem to be underlying patterns, interconnectedness, as in, for example, a large group of starlings flying together, swooping, driving, diving, changing together, as if breathing together. And so the complete title of Christine's recent book, Almanac, A Murmuration, is a memoir of sorts, featuring prose poems and life stories, issued by Excelsior Editions, of the State University of New York Press. We learn that Christine is the author of this book, as well as three full-length books of poetry, Crave, Appetite for the Divine, and also Remorseless Loyalty. A recipient of the Pushcart Prize, Gallineau's poetry and essays have been widely published in journals such as Prairie Schooner, New Letters, The New York Times, Green Mountains Review, North American Review, and many other places. Gallineau teaches poetry and creative nonfiction in the Maslow Family Graduate Program in Creative Writing at Wilkes University in Wilkes-Barre. She served for many years as Associate Director of the Creative Writing Program at Binghamton University. She and her husband live on a farm in the upper Susquehanna River Valley. And she made a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us about Almanac and to read a bit as well. What about you and writing when you were young, Christine? Were you scribbling in the margins of your books? Were you reading a lot or both?
Oh, I was reading voraciously, yes. There was the Pontiac Free Library, which I could walk to. And I had a card at the library very young and soon read through all the horse books, all the Nancy Drew, all the Trixie Belden, all the Hardy Boys, on and on until finally I was reading out of the adult section, which the librarians allowed me to do because they knew I'd read everything already. No, I'm not a scribble in the margins type. To me, the book was sacred. You didn't write in it. When I went to college and you were supposed to put notes in your book and stuff, it still gives me a little bit of a pause, even do that, to annotate like that.
What did you decide when you did go to college to do with your love of reading? How did that figure in your path in college?
Well, I knew since I was 9 that I wanted to be a writer. I didn't know how to get there. I didn't know what that path was like. And actually, at the Wilkes program that I teach in now, the founding group of us, that was one of the things that we shared, was that it was very difficult for us to figure out our path to become writers. And so that was one of the things that we really focused on, was how to get that information out. But I would do things like read biographies of writers to try to figure out how did they get there, But that was very difficult, to find a pathway to become a writer as a woman and as a poet. It was not easy to find that pathway. So, Robert Frost, I was a New Englander. He was a New Englander. He was on a farm. I wanted to be on a farm. But, the path that he took actually is he went to England. And Ezra Pound, of all people, championed him. So, this was not a path that was going to work for me. The very few women back in the late 60s, early 70s, when I was in college, that were in any of your textbooks or you were introduced to at all tended to be Sylvia Plath, and then Anne Sexton. And it was almost as if to become a well-known woman poet, suicide was a great career move. But that did not appeal to me. Blessedly, Anne Sexton led me to Maxine Cumin, who was a wonderful poet, a wonderful woman, life-affirming, living on a horse farm in New England. I mean, it couldn't have been any closer, really. I wrote Max a fan letter through her publisher, as I recall, way back, and I tucked in a few of my poems, and that happens to her so often. I mean, she'd won the Pulitzer. She'd been the consultant to the poetry consultant at the Library of Congress, which now we call the Poet Laureate. So she certainly heard from a lot of fangirls. I'd been smart enough to tuck in poems that had to do with horses. And as she said to me later, I couldn't stop myself from reading those. And that established, to begin with, it was letters back and forth. It was before email. But she encouraged me. And when at last my first book came out, she asked me if she could blurb it. So, Yeah, she was an important influence to me in terms of, particularly of showing me a pathway for a woman to become a poet and to have the life that I wanted to have. You know, most of the time in our correspondence, we didn't talk about poetry. We talked about the garden and the horses. She had plenty of people she could talk about poetry with, but that is much, it's the life, that fullness of a life was a real example to me.
I'd love if we could start with the book's title. Sometimes we can wait to talk about the title, and sometimes we go on and then come back to the title. But I'm so intrigued by the juxtaposition of almanac and a murmuration, and how almanac might tend to be a structuring of time in a regular way. And then a murmuration, when we think about birds, there's order there, but it's the chaos theory, sort of, and the order emerges in a different way, and there's a flow. So the almanac and a murmuration are both ways of bringing order into our lives or experience, but each is different in its way, and you had to be aware of that.
Right. Yes, thanks for bringing that up. I think you're right. We do need to talk about that early on, because the book does have a form that's unusual, and it's called, as you say, almanac, and the year is a through line. There is a through line where I'm like 4 years old at the beginning and I'm about this age at the end. But within that, I've come to realize that everybody knows what a murmuration is, but a lot of people don't know what the word is that means that. And a murmuration is when a group of birds, individual birds, lift into this agile cloud where the whole group creates form that merges and emerges and forms and reforms. And the book, within that framework of the seasons, it brings up a large number of issues that introduce, and then something else comes in, and then it reintroduces, almost like the way that a symphony works, where a theme will come along and then we'll go somewhere else, but then we will return, and that's what happens throughout the book. And the other thing that I feel connects the stories and gives a through line and gives a coherence is this idea of narrative, of stories, that we shape our lives around stories. We shape our lives, our individual lives, around, you know, we try to make sense and meaning for our own lives out of the incoherence of everyday life and everything that happens by giving it a narrative, giving it a story. And that is true at a community level, a national community level, and it's also true in terms of us as a species within the other species and within the planet that sustains us all. And so those three, personal level, the community level, and the universal level, is something that, you know, concerns me throughout and that we keep looking at, is looking at narrative.
And the way you have chosen to divide up, you'll give us a paragraph, maybe a month. We've got sort of January through December.
Yeah. Each one of those has 12 sections.
And so sometimes you might start out with a theme or a story to tell. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it when you give us the beauty of your writing about nature. It's just a new way or a fresh way of looking at what's happening around us now. Yeah. But that's the beauty and the connection to nature. But then you do tell us some striking stories. And in October, for example, you make your way to the burning of the Amazon and try to help us understand that in the same chapter, October, when you're considering mortality and that we're implicated in that as well. So there are those calls to us.
Yeah, October, each one of the months starts with, I would call it a prose poem that is related to that month. In October, it does eventually go to the burning of the Amazon. But before that, we get a different burning. We're in the Revolutionary War, right in the area along the Susquehanna River Valley where I live now, which the town of Windsor, where I live, was the village of Aquaga or Onequaga, called both, that was a very important Haudenosaunee settlement because it was at the shortest portage point between the Susquehanna River and the Delaware River, which were the highways of the time. And so there was an important village there that played a pivotal role in the Revolutionary War. It may be hard for us to picture now, but that was the Western frontier at the time. And Brant's volunteers, Joseph Brant Mohawk, who led a group of volunteers, largely white loyalists. There were other indigenous people in the group, but it was largely white loyalists, though it was always presented at the time of, you know, the wild Indians on the wilderness were attacking. But they went as far down as here into Pennsylvania, where we are here, and as far up to Unadilla in that direction. And in October of 1778, the village was attacked and totally burned.
And this is a year for us to take special note of that as the country is getting ready to dig back into the stories that we have told about the American Revolution.
Yeah, I think that I'm so grateful that the book is not still sitting on my computer, because it does, in that it found a good home with SUNY Press and is out there in the world, because one of the major things that it wants to encounter is how does narrative work for us and against us, and how do we as a country form these stories that tell us who we are, and how does that influence how we act, our understanding of who we are, how does that influence what happens in the real world? We sometimes think of, you know, stories, fiction, they're not really real, but they have an extremely real impact in the world. And I happen to have lived for a long time in the upper Susquehanna River Valley there, right where Onequaga was. And the other place that is part of my imagination and that I've had an association with since I was 2 years old is Mashpee, Massachusetts, where the Wampanoags were, the indigenous people who were part of that first Thanksgiving. You know, the two origin stories that we tell about the European encounter with the indigenous people of the United States. We have two, John Smith and Pocahontas and Thanksgiving. And in Almanac, I do talk about both of those by using the original sources of where that came from. So John Smith talked about that first encounter. He wrote three different versions. We took one that we have enshrined, and that is why it's still today. Every school child has heard of John Smith and Pocahontas, but that was not his original. It's not the only one. And I've always thought it was interesting to look at those differences and to look at the way things are shaded and why. I think it's crucial right now.
In presenting these stories told from perhaps the standpoint of the indigenous peoples and not the spin that we have come to understand in history, are showing us two cultures, societies who do perceive the world and the cycles of the seasons and the natural world in ways that are different from us. So it's not just that it's a political situation, but it's also in keeping with your fascination and the importance of nature in the natural world.
Right, which links the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves as a community at a political, cultural level to the stories we tell ourselves about the planet, you know, at the macro level.
And in choosing the word and the almanac as a structuring principle, one part of it, did you go back and look up what over the centuries almanacs meant to various cultures?
I actually didn't research that almanac as much as anything came out of, you know, my 50-some years on the farm itself. And as I, you know, began, the project developed. The project happened parts of it happened before COVID, but then it, you know, took, particularly with the health issues that I went through with that, it took some time. But I started off with the idea of, you know, Georgics, or, you know, poetry about the farm and all. And I was thinking, you know, I was calling it upstate Georgics to begin with, so that I always had that organizing idea of, you know, the cycle of the year and the cycle of the seasons and what the land had to tell us and to show us. So that idea was there from the beginning. Gradually, one of the things is even, you know, difficult for the publisher and for bookstores. Bookstores don't all put it in the same place. I've seen it put in biography. I've seen it put in poetry. I can't deny that it is a memoir of my life to some degree, but I think it's a memoir of place at least as much. At least as much.
Yes, it's a very place-centered exploration. And in your exploration of the spaces and the places you know, that helps us to ask, what is our relationship to the places we have been or where we are? And your stories tend to be rooted in the soil. When you're talking about bulldozing, you're going to make this lovely perennial garden, and tell the story about you as a little one in Rhode Island when there was the field and you just wanted to be part of the ragweed field because you felt so connected.
Yeah, it's interesting that I have never forgotten the feeling of, you know, folding down those ragweed and making like a little room within the field and then laying in that space and watching the sky and the clouds and just, yeah, as you say, feeling integrated into that, which we all are. We are integrated. We just forget it so often.
And the lovely thing, too, is the description of your establishing the perennial garden and comparing it to the song lines and the mapping of the important places and events in the Aborigines' life in Australia. Mm-hmm. But you have your own personal mapping because plants were given to you. Right. You have a grandmother. Yes. And that's another exquisite way of thinking about our lives and our connection to a garden.
Yeah. I first heard about the Aborigines' song lines in a small paragraph within an article I was reading at the Atlantic magazine back when it was called Atlantic Monthly, I mean, a long time ago. And I was so taken with, for people that don't know, the song line, the Aborigines song line, they live in the outback, which to us, to me certainly, would look like a dangerous desert place. And they don't have paper and pen. They don't have, you know, how did they map that area? And they mapped that area with story, with song. And they had to get from A to B. There was a certain storyline. And each place that you got to, there was a cultural story for the group of something that had happened there. And if the stories in the landscape matched, you were safe. You were where you needed to be. And I just, from the moment of hearing about that, I have just felt such a connection to that understanding of how humans and the planet that gives them home interact. Because that is how, story is how we interact with ourselves internally and with the world externally. That's how our mind works, is image and stories. And so I just thought that for me, that was such a beautiful evocation of that. Actually, my first published book is a chapbook that is one single long poem called North American Songline, where I used that idea to try to understand for myself how that worked within my life. But that idea has always been strong.
Before we talk about accidents and horses and long COVID, the understanding, the deep physical, visceral understanding of horses that you have is remarkable for people who don't know horses. You were reading horse books when you first got your library card.
Right, I was reading horse books. Yeah, as a child, on my 8th birthday, my parents gave me 3 riding lessons. And then every birthday after that, my father would bravely take me to a riding stable at Goddard Park in East Greenwich, Rhode Island, overlooking Narragansett Bay. And I had that once a year thing. But gradually, when I went to college, I went to the University of Connecticut. I was living in Connecticut at the time, so that was my state school. And I went there to study English. But my first week there, most of the state colleges began as agricultural schools. And as it turned out, the University of Connecticut raised Morgan horses. And there was an ad in the student newspaper for riding lessons, and I signed up immediately. And as my instructor told me at the time, he said, well, yeah, you're a 18-year-old beginner, but that means you have no bad habits. So from that moment on, I've had access to horses. What I think is so, I mean, there are a lot of animal lovers that, you know, love their cats or love their dogs. And cats don't really adjust to you, but you can live, you know, a horse is somewhere between livestock and companion animal. To those who love them, they're definitely companion animals. But they are of such a size, they can hurt you without meaning to. So you really, you have to adjust to them. You have to understand their language. And as I talk about in Almanac, I do think of riding as a kind of kinetic language, a language that you speak with the whole of your body. And there's a translation involved also. If you're going to translate something from Russian and something from French, there are different idioms. There are different, you have to understand about the culture of that language in order to really do a good job. And similarly with horses, you have to understand the culture of being a horse if you're going to be doing a good job. That to me has always been the relationship between my writing and my riding also, is that I think they're both languages, and the rhythm of riding, there's, you know, each one of the gates, a walk is a 4-beat gait, a trot is a 2-beat gait, a canter is a 3-beat gait. And that attention to rhythm, I think, has helped in my poetry and has come out in my poetry. And it also comes out in the syntax of the prose of this book as well, I would say, even though this is considered prose. And I also, you know, think that that relationship, there's a humility you have to have. You're not in control, you're in connection. And to bring that same sort of humility to your writing allows you to discover things you didn't know you knew, and maybe you didn't know until you wrote it.
What happens when you have an accident with a horse you know? You say the horse can hurt you, not meaning to. How do you then deal with getting up, healing, and going back to riding?
So the bad accident that I did have had less to do with the horse than it had to do with the fact that I was still recovering from long COVID, which affected my balance. And it's balance that keeps you on a horse. You're not hanging on with your legs. You're staying, you're keeping your center of balance over their center of balance, and gravity is what's holding you on. So I had finished riding Castle and, you know, was just cooling out, as any athlete does. You cool out at the end of a session. We'd gone, you know, we'd done all the work we were going to do. He got stung. And he kicked out high and up behind. And if he'd done it only once, I would have been okay. But he did it twice. Now, when I came off, the gate to the ring was wide open, and his friends were just feet away. He went and stood by the gate with a look like, I don't know what she's doing on the ground there, but I know I'm supposed to be working, so I'll just wait here until. So I was not afraid of him in any way. It was not, you know, it was not something that he did. And it, and that was 50-some years into my riding, you know. And there is a moment where you have to make that decision. Am I going to give up the pet? My neurosurgeon, after all of the doctors said, never ride again, never ride again, except for the neurosurgeon, who said, it's your choice between risk and passion.
We know you value courage, and we know the choice you've made. Now, in talking about being rooted in the soil and being embodied creatures that we are subject to the slings and arrows of illness and accident. The thing that is important to me about what you do is you give us the reality of what it means to be human, and that does involve risk and being embodied and pain and perhaps suffering in that way. It's not the only thing, but it is to be taken into consideration.
Right. We can't transcend that. That's, you know, my first 6 years of schooling were in a parochial school, and there was this very strict division, as it were, between the spirit, the soul, and the body. And the soul was valued over the body. But I would have to say life taught me that they're inextricably linked, and the true sublime comes through the both. I would say that I talk about that in Almanac when I talk about birth. I would say that that's the passage that most expresses that, which talks about birth experiences that I had, but also I've spent a lot of years midwifing foals.
That's a wonderful thing, too, because it shows the commonality that this is giving life, and this is what's involved in that, right?
Yeah, I think that it's everyone experiences a sense of, nobody is a cynic at the moment of birth. They talk about there not being any cynics or any atheists in the ditches in war, and that's probably true also, but there are no cynics at the moment of birth either. And everybody has hope that it's a new start. And I think that we're certainly at a moment right now in this country where we're looking for hope and we're looking for renewal, and that being connected to the natural world helps to keep us going. Keeps not just that it gives us hope, but that it gives us a sense of responsibility for what's at stake.
Having been a writer of poems and a teacher of creative fiction and poetry and helping others find their voices and making a wise and perhaps surprising comparison between writing with a computer or a pen and riding as a language. How does the reading of poems or a memoir, which is a hybrid of poetic prose poems and poetic images in a structure like this, how do you suspect or how do you feel that that impacts us?
Narrative and metaphor are kind of the two major tools within a writer's kit that we do tell ourselves, you know, humans are drawn to story. And one of the most powerful aspects and components of story is metaphor, because metaphor, rather than just describing something, gives us the feeling that we've had this sudden insight, that we've said something a little beyond words. So certainly looking to have both of those at work. There's an old chestnut that gets repeated and it gets attributed to many different people. It was really some cavalry officer whose name I can't recall now, who said it's something about the outside of a horse that's good for the inside of a man. And I think what he means, I've given that, I mean, obviously this doesn't just have to be a man, it can be a woman. But what I think is that working with horses requires courage and it requires patience and empathy. And for the most part, we're born naturally leaning to one or the other of those. And so that you need to expand yourself. You need to learn something you don't have in order to be good at something you're passionate about. And to me, that's one of the great gifts of horsemanship, of working with horses, of what's one of the great gifts that the species gives us. By being willing, because let's face it, look at the size of them. They are willing to be in a relationship with us. And I do bring that over to, you know, I could sort of think about narrative and metaphor as being those two parts that by using both, it expands.
Is there anything you might be inclined to read for us, having just had the conversation that we did? Something about place, perhaps? Something featuring your exquisite use of language?
Well, I'm trying to find the part about going quahogging with my dad and my brother. Yeah, Yeah, that's... There are landscapes that imprinted early and shaped my sense of the solace the world could offer me. Breakheart Pond in Rhode Island's Arcadia State Park, with inlets choked by the pulpy pads and luminescent petals of wild water lilies. The wooded bridle paths of Goddard Park with Narragansett Bay glinting through the tree trunks. Beavertail, the tide pools and astringent granite slabs aslant on the point of Connecticut Island in the same bay. The ocean path at Acadia National Park in Maine. The spit at Papanesset in Mashpee, Massachusetts on Cape Cod. Elizabeth Bishop has a wonderful poem called In the Waiting Room, in which she palpably enacts the experience of a young child recognizing her own human selfness. You are an I, you are an Elizabeth. She's astonished and more than a little appalled to realize. A not insignificant portion of my own grasp of this revelatory discovery of selfness, of inexplicable and inextricable embeddedness in humanity and mortality, I associate with the spit at Papanesset, walking its length with my cousin Donna, that long strand of open beach crossed by tank-like prehistoric horseshoe crabs and pierced by the cries and swoops of nesting terns, gulls, and piping plovers, or waking before dawn with my father and older brother Gibby to walk to the cove at low tide, quahog rakes and buckets in hand, waiting for more light, bare feet in the primordial ooze, the sucking lap of the dark salt water around our shins, pale light turning to pastel, to petal pink, the sky, the sea, the exposed sand bed of the cove pocked with air holes, the tiny spoutings of the buried quahogs, their own respiration inadvertently betraying their hiding places, immersed then in both remorseless vulnerability and heartbreaking beauty, both merging and emerging, composite and alone.
Christine Gelinneau, reading from Almanac, A Murmuration, A Memoir Meditation. Those were words from January, the opening of Almanac. And we had a chance to talk with her about the form of Almanac, her concerns in Almanac, the power of language that she believes in so fiercely. Christine Gelinneau teaches poetry and creative nonfiction in the Maslow Family Low Residency Graduate Program in Creative Writing at Wilkes University here in Wilkes-Barre. She was with that program right from the start. She and her husband live on a farm in the upper Susquehanna River Valley, and she paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us and read from Almanac. Almanac has been released by Excelsior Editions, State University of New York Press. That's the imprint. And if you'd like more information, to read more, to hear, she has a wonderful blog and a wonderful podcast of her own. And to read more and discover more about Christine Gelinneau, you can check her website, and that is Christine, with a C, ChristineGelinneau.com. GELINEAU, ChristineGelinneau.com.